Park in Portland. That'll be 4 o'clock to 7 p.m. And on Friday, January 22nd, Portland State University and the Portland State University Foundation hosts an online panel on the 48th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Panelist Loretta Ross, author of Radical Reproductive Justice, joins director Jan Hocken and physicians featured in the film Our Bodies, Our Doctors. And they'll be joined as well by attorney Leah Rutnam with the ACLU of Washington. They'll map the road ahead for reproductive justice as the right-wing Supreme Court seems poised to overturn Roe v. Wade. For more information on that event, please go to the Road Ahead for Roe Facebook event page. This has been Denise Morris for The Old Mole. We'll see you next week.
Portland.
Tune into KBOO for Bridge Over Troubled Water, a tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Monday, January the 18th from noon to 5:30 p.m. This retrospective program honors Dr. King's work through a combination of archives, audio, and contemporary interviews, featuring artists, activists, public officials, and community members who have participated in this event over the years. Bridge Over Troubled Waters draws inspiration from Dr. King's mission to ensure peace, social justice, civil rights, and human dignity for all. Again, that's Bridge Over Troubled Water, a tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King on Monday, January the 18th from noon to 5:30 p.m. here on Community Radio, KBOO.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On our show today, author and academic Noliwe Rooks will join us to discuss her book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education, a book all the more relevant in light of the historic teacher strike in LA. Then we'll speak with Leslie Hinkson, whose book is entitled Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. Finally, we'll wrap the show up with an in-depth commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal on the current state of the world called Cracks in the Walls of Empire. Stay tuned. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Donald Trump's Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos is finding it hard to attend public events without being the target of protests. The virulently strong supporter of school privatization and charter schools has become a linchpin for mass dismay of the state of our public school system. But privatization did not begin with DeVos. It has a long history embedded within the early days of racial desegregation and the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision. In a new book, Professor Noliwe Rooks writes about how private investment in public education has skyrocketed, and the result is worse achievement outcomes, more segregation, more privatization. Noliwe Rooks is the Director of American Studies and Associate Professor of Africana Studies at Cornell University, former Associate Director of African American Studies at Princeton University. She's written four books, including White Money, Black Power, and Hair Raising. She joins me to discuss her newest book, Cutting School: Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk about history, because that is such an important context to the story that you tell in your book and really should be the framework for how we look at where our public schools are today. We remember the Supreme Court decision of Brown versus Board of Education being this momentous time when a huge victory of the civil rights movement happened. But right from the beginning, those who didn't like the idea of racial segregation began the work to undermine public education and the access of everyone to public education, right?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think it's interesting when we teach that moment, it's a real success story, the moment of Brown v. Board, the moment where the Supreme Court steps in to say, you know, as a nation, we cannot accept the idea of separate but equal, of racial segregation, of laws that say it's illegal for black and white children or children who are non-white and white children to be educated together. The thing is, we sort of stop at that moment where Brown v. Board says, you know, offers us this hopeful view of America, and we don't look at all of the fallout that took place as a result. Many, many former slaveholding states, states in the South, were willing to go so far as to close their entire school districts as opposed to adhere to the Brown v. Board. And some of the children in some of the states where they had experiments where they would try to have a few children integrate predominantly white schools. In one, we just celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Little Rock Nine from Little Rock, Arkansas. You know, the National Guard had to be called out. The 101st Airborne had to be called out just to walk these children into the school. And once they got into the school, they were subjected to their classmates, their white classmates, throwing dynamite at their feet in the stairwell, or throwing acid at them, or having white teachers attack them regularly. So while the Supreme Court did did the right thing and did the thing that we all celebrate, when we look further and see at how committed white people in the South, and increasingly white people across the country, are to maintaining white-only educational spaces, it really should give us all pause.
You write in your book, you coin a term called segronomics. So let's talk about that. How has money from wealthy white elites been used to further segregation, to sort of undo what the Supreme Court decision attempted to do?
Right. Well, I mean, what I talk about is how there's this real swing in this country around education between plundering dollars that are set aside to educate not just children of color, but poor children. There are a lot of poor white children who get swept up in these schemes. So they either plunder or they hoard it for the use of children who are not of color and not poor. Segronomics is a term that throughout history, when you look at the kind of idiosyncratic educational schemes that people come up with to educate poor children and children of color, they only work with high levels of racial and economic segregation. It doesn't work. It's not a business model. It's not a plan. it's not successful if you're talking about integrated spaces. But it with high levels of racial and economic segregation, there's all kinds of educational products like virtual charter schools, for example. In some regions of the country, it's one of the fastest growing segments of education. It's specifically for rural children, for hard to educate children, for poor children. There's a push on to get kids who are on Native American reservations and foster kids to educate them with this idiosyncratic form where the children sit in front of the computer for 8 hours a day, have limited contact with teachers. But the businesses that have put together this particular model are charging as much, often if not more, than what it costs traditional brick and mortar schools to educate kids. It's a cash cow. And it's only aimed at those communities that are highly racially and economically segregated. That's just one example. And so looking at the history of American education, but certainly now, the term that I came up with is segronomics. It is an economic model that requires that kind of inequality in order to be profitable.
Now, is it that vulnerable schools, or I should say vulnerable communities that have schools, are targeted by privatization activists, or because they're lucrative, or is it that money making isn't the real goal, furthering segregation is?
Well, they, in many ways, they go hand in hand. And so for the charter school, the brick and mortar charter school industry, they have this term, they're called 90-90-90 schools. It's 90% of color, 90% below federal poverty cutoffs, and 90% of the children are underperforming in the schools. So in schools like that, or in areas, neighborhoods, regions that have schools like that, those are the regions that the large growth charter school networks that some will start to target because of the demographics. So they've noticed that those demographics are there. And the only thing that has ever in the history of our country systemically worked, worked to lift all the boats, not idiosyncratically, really is racial and economic integration. And we didn't have a very long period of time when we really went after it hard, but that is literally the only thing that has worked in a widespread kind of way. So, if you know that, it's not a secret, most of the literature, most of the research, you're hard-pressed to find anything else that has worked. But if you as an education person decide that you're going to start a new education product, a business, a school, and you go and look for the most vulnerable students, the most isolated, the most segregated students as the people to deliver your product to, and your product is not based on any kind of known, there's nothing about those kind that the segregation levels or charter schools, or there's nothing about that that guarantees, that works, that we can say over time is going to eradicate these unequal educational outcomes.
And in fact, isn't the opposite true? Don't you see that after years and years and years of private money flowing into the educational system, we're actually seeing outcomes not get better, but actually get worse?
For many, many places. So there's usually a handful of high-performing charter schools, privatized products that actually do test better. But if that's your only matrix, if the only thing you're trying to do is raise test scores, there are some schools that do that. Overall, though, for charter schools in particular, it's only about 20-something percent of schools that overperform public schools. The other 60-something percent, 68%, are at par or doing worse. And yet we are shoveling money into that segment hand over fist because it makes sense to the people who are in power, who are in control, who can push these kinds of measures. It makes sense to them that the public school system isn't doing well. We need something else. We need innovation. Let's let business do it. But they're not held to the same kinds of standards around having to show and prove that what they're doing is actually working.
Well, if you were to say to Eli Broad or Mark Zuckerberg or a lot of these sort of socially liberal, wealthy funders of privatization and charter schools that they were engaging in something you call segronomics, they would be aghast, right? They wouldn't like that term. They wouldn't see themselves as actually furthering racial segregation.
Yeah, I think that what they say, very often people of that who are part of the so-called ed reform movement say is, we just care about the kids. We're willing to do whatever we can in order to make sure that kids learn. And they will say, it's another thing that they constantly say is, you know, because kids are poor, does it mean that they can't learn? So it's a kind of evasive response to the issue that if you have an educational product, that you're not willing to have your children be educated with. Their children do not go to schools that use these kinds of, all of the different methods supposedly that you need to use to teach poor children and children of color.
So they're fine experimenting on other people's kids.
They're experimenting on these other kids, and again, with methods that they wouldn't have for their own kids. And that is consistently, for me, where the line in the sand is. You know, if you have some good ideas and you want to innovate with your own. You know, try it out with your kids, try it out with wealthy kids, try it out with kids who don't have so far to fall if it doesn't work. But when someone like Mark Zuckerberg takes over a school system in Newark, puts $100 million into it, and at the end of the 5 years, as he did, you know, and at the end of the 5 years said, oh, this was a failure, but I learned a lot. You know, you can't say that the kids in the district learned a lot. You can say you learned a lot and you wouldn't do the same thing, but this is 5 years of education that children in the district have had to suffer through. I consistently say, poor children, children of color deserve what wealthy children get, what white children get, the same forms of education.
Now, Noliwe, let's also talk about how education fits within the broader societal structures built in the United States. I mean, education is central to the sort of financial and economic future of any country and to individual futures as well. But it seems to be that we are a country that just hasn't decided whether government funding of institutions is a good thing or not. That this is an ideological battle with very real outcomes, because public education, you know, denounced as a socialist model on the one hand, and then a lot of these philanthropists trying to force a business model onto what they think education should be, in a way trying to force delivery of education into a capitalist model, right?
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, as you said, we're in a moment where there is an ideology afoot about privatization, about smaller government, about innovation. The term that you will see pop up in a lot of literature around business and philanthropy really is that we need to be able to innovate. And in order to innovate, we need to free ourselves from regulations, from government policies, from workers who are unionized, that we can't make the money that we need to make if there are organized groups of people standing in our way, if there are regulations standing in our way. And so that term innovation, it seems to me, covers over a whole host of ills that has to do with widening inequality in the country. Where there's certain people who have access to the lobbyists and the elite, the political and economic elite, who and can make laws that favor their ideological perspective. And then there's others, poor people, people who are not as well connected, people who are farther from the centers of power, who don't have lobbyists, who don't have people to do their bidding. And in the face of a lot of the gerrymandering and other things that we're seeing, their actual votes. So when you have to suspend democracy, specifically in the case of education, a lot of the school districts where you see some of these experiments popping up all over the place, there's no more boards of education. There's no more democratically elected voice that's to support the students, the struggling students. They're government appointed by people who believe in this innovation, who believe in privatization. Mm. And so it's much more the case that parents in poor communities are no different than parents in wealthy communities. They care deeply about the education of their kids. They're willing to do almost anything, if it's experimental or not, if you say that it will work. But what's happening is, because that's just about what parents are privileging, is the welfare of their children and education, and these ideologies around privatization are privileging something else entirely, the ability to make money. So those two things are at odds with each other. Mm-hmm. And poor communities and parents are just simply being outspent and outorganized.
Now, Noliwe, you're a very high-achieving person, Princeton University, Cornell University, yet you write in your book that you started out in public schools, and that, in fact, you might have been part of the integration of schools in your own experience. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I hadn't really thought about it like I was part of an integration experiment. My husband actually found a photograph, my fifth grade photograph, where I'm the only black child in the picture. I think there's like 24, 25 of us. It's a bunch of white kids and me. And he sort of asked me, you know, like, what's up with this? Like, how did this come to be? And that's when I really started to remember that. So.
And where did you go to school, by the way?
That school was Clearwater, Florida. Florida, like a lot of southern states, you know, like I said earlier, really fought the idea of integration. So this was in the early 70s when I was in school, but I was a part of the first class of black children who were brought out to the county, Pinellas County, outside of the city that we lived in, to integrate the schools. And it was the tail end, 1972, was the tail end of what Southern states called massive resistance. And it was massive resistance to integration in public schools. And so they had just been, you know, the federal government broke this whole massive resistance thing by refusing to give federal dollars to fund schools that were still segregated. And that's what started to undo it. And so I was a part of the first class of students to integrate a school. And I think the thing that I remember most, like as it came back to me really, was not anything, you know, no one had to call out the Federal Guard, and, you know, people were not unkind. I wasn't being attacked in school at all. But I also had no friends the entire time I was there. I have no memories of sort of, you know, sleepovers.
Oh,
or,
wow.
You know, being on the phone, chatting with people, being a part of a clique, like the things that you associate with high school, none of that was a part of my reality. I and the other black children, we took the bus there together. We were all separated, so we were all in different classes, and we took the bus together home. So I was tolerated, perfectly tolerated. But I was not accepted. I was not a part of the community.
And so today we have a situation where you have our public schools dominated by black and brown children. Depending upon which school district you go to, you would have, yes. There are plenty of mostly white residential neighborhoods whose public schools are mostly filled with white children, much better funded. So how do you compare the state of how our public schools look today compared to how they looked in the immediate aftermath of the Brown decision?
Well, you know, there's a lot of research to talk about how the schools have resegregated to levels that we haven't seen since the 1950s. And that's in the face of everyone. Like, you're hard pressed. Like, in the 1950s, you were hard pressed to find any white people who thought integration was a good idea in the South. Or if they were there, they were not the minority and they were not vocal. I'm not saying there were none, but they were not the most vocal folks. In contemporary America, you're hard pressed to find white people who are really going to go on record saying we oppose racial integration. We know all the reasons why this is seen as progress, and yet, but when it comes to individual choice, when it comes to our biases, when it comes to making the hard kinds of choices that we need to make sure that our schools are integrated, we don't do it. We are opposed to what it takes to achieve integration. And for the most part, it comes down to this idea of choice, that people should be able to choose where they want to send their kids. And we don't really interrogate how it is that the presence of poor people or the presence of people of color for those who are wealthy automatically signals a lesser educational experience, period, full stop. And I think so. It's who we think high achievers look like. It's gotten so bad that at this point, children of like white children and wealthy children are now a minority in our public school system nationwide. Like if you look at the whole nation, there's certainly some regions of the country where that's not the case. But overall, white students are now making up less than 50%, barely less, like 48.9%. And most of the children, a bare majority of the children qualify for free lunch, which is a marker for poverty. So we're looking at a moment, this has been since 2014, we're looking at a moment where public school is actually coming to mean poor, is coming to mean of color. And if we can't disassociate the ways that we link poor and of color with poor performing, with underachieving, then I don't know that we'll be able to right this ship.
And meanwhile, private money from wealthy philanthropists continues to flow into the system with very little to actually show that it's doing anything positive for the school system. I mean, it seems just like, you know, that saying, it's a definition of insanity where you keep repeating the same experiment with the same variables and expecting different results. So at some point, aren't the Zuckerbergs, Broads, and other, and I should say, by the way, Democrats, just like Republicans who've been fueling this fight, at some point, aren't they going to say, all right, this just isn't working. We need to realize that our capitalist ideology does not fit with the educational system.
Well, so I think if quality education was the actual goal, we'd see them doing something different.
What is the actual goal then?
I mean, it looks to me, it looks to me like making money is the actual goal. I mean, the budget, the federal, state, and local budget for education combined is between $500 and $600 billion each year. It's up there with healthcare in terms of the amount of money that can be made. And so you really do have, some people may actually believe that they are trying to better the condition of children who are not wealthy and who are of color and who are struggling, who the traditional public schools are failing. However, I'm constantly curious as to how it is then that they don't branch out from a very narrow set of prescriptions to fix this issue. It's always charter schools. It's always deunionize the teaching force and have test scores. It's more testing. There's four or five things that no matter where you are on the ideological spectrum, you say this right here is what will work. And because these people talk to each other so often, and because they have whole foundations and they have panels and they have experts who support them, they really, it's almost like this echo chamber. So they really, despite the fact that you're looking at something very, very different, sort of like those inaugural photographs, where you're kind of like, some people are looking at inaugural photographs and going, huh, those look kind of empty. And others are going, no, see, they're very full. You almost have this same kind of echo chamber taking place where, depending on where you are on the ideological spectrum, you're going, no, this is good. You see how it's much better. Like New Orleans, for example, was our former Secretary of Education, Arnie Duncan. And he's running around talking about how this was great that the city got drowned and the public school system had to be dismantled, and because it got the innovation and technology got to take center stage. And yet, by most measures, by people who are not paid by these industries, by these ed industries, to say something different, the school system is still a solid D or F. It's like a F+, school system. So you did dismantle the whole thing. So you did get to put in the teachers that you wanted. You did get to, you know, go with these non-traditional forms of education. And still the majority of children are not doing any better on these tests that y'all valorize so much.
Well, Noliwe, thank you so much for joining us today and good luck with the book.
Oh, thank you.
My guest has been Professor Noliwe Rooks, Director of American Studies and Associate Professor of Africana Studies at Cornell University, former Associate Director of African American Studies at Princeton University. We've been discussing her newest book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. You've heard of the subprime mortgage crisis, where home buyers of color were targeted by banks for high interest loans. But what about expanding that framing to healthcare and medicine? A new book takes on racial disparities in the delivery and costs of healthcare to examine how medical debt disproportionately impacts people of color. The book is called Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. In it, contributors trace how pharmaceutical companies market in specific ways to certain racial groups, as well as how the repayment of medical debt can be viewed within the historical framework of past medical abuses. While there is an ongoing crisis in healthcare in the U.S., how healthcare, debt, and race intersect ought to be a crucial component of the national dialogue. My guest is Leslie R. Hinkson. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Georgetown University and the co-editor with Nadine Ellers of the book Subprime Health, Debt, and Race in U.S. Medicine. Welcome to the program, Leslie.
No, thanks for having me, Sonali.
How important is it for us to look at the history of medical abuses of communities of color, from disproportionate testing and unethical experimentation to just, neglect by the healthcare industry of communities of color? Is that historical framework a crucial issue?
Oh, I think it's incredibly crucial, and for a few reasons. The first, we have issues of trust, right? And, you know, in one of the contributions in the volume, Ruha Benjamin and I actually take on this idea of trust in clinical trials, and how very often when people conducting clinical trials can't find enough subjects of color, particularly African Americans, to take part in the clinical trials, they think of it as, you know, through this sort of deficiency model, whereby they wonder, what's wrong with these people? We're trying to do something for their community, and yet they're not participating in trials, rather than thinking about it the other way and saying, given the history of medicine in the United States vis-a-vis people of color and African Americans in particular, how do we earn their trust? So that's number one. I think also number two, I think, you know, we seem to think that health disparities in the United States sort of arise simply from either biological difference, you know, as though race is a biological fact, or through cultural deficiencies of people of color. And actually, these arise because of, number one, a history of medical neglect. Number two, a history of, you know, very often deliberate, you could even call it medical malpractice when it comes to people of color.
Right. I mean, there's an ugly history of scientists using biological determinism to justify racism.
Exactly, right? I mean, you know, we can start with the eugenics movement, but it goes back even further than that.
And we shouldn't be terribly surprised, as you said, that these things linger today. There's been in the news a viral photograph of a nursing book that examines cultural differences in response to pain that has been making the rounds of social media, where people are sort of shocked to see that in a contemporary nursing book, you have a section about how different communities respond to pain. For example, Hispanics may believe that pain is a form of punishment and that suffering must be endured if they are to enter heaven. Jews may be vocal and demanding of assistance. Arabs and Muslims may not request pain medicine, but instead thank Allah for pain if it is the result of a healing medical procedure, and so on. This has been making the rounds of social media, and it's quite shocking because it is a contemporary nursing textbook. However, this has echoes of past views, racialized views of the experience of pain within medicine, right?
Yes, and you know, and one of the things that's so ironic about this is I could actually see this as being part of this whole seemingly well-intentioned movement towards ensuring that we have cultural competency training in medical and nursing schools. And you know, cultural competency, if it's not done correctly, can actually just lead to the trotting out of these old, worn, time and time again use stereotypes of groups of people. And that doesn't help to get them greater care.
Right. So we see some very serious disparities in healthcare outcomes among people of color. So for example, if you look at the issue of cancer, breast cancer, you see while white women are more susceptible or are at higher risk of getting breast cancer, Black women are at more risk of dying from it. How has the medical establishment viewed these disparities? Going back to what you were saying earlier, do they see them more as intrinsic to that racial group rather than the result of social inequities?
Well, there is a raging debate about this right now, right? I mean, there is one camp that thinks that, you know, there are genes that are specific to Black women that actually make their cancer, their different forms of breast cancer sort of more like stronger and more likely to lead to death, right? They're more virulent strains. The problem that I have with that is that, you know, within the Black female population, there is just so much ethnic diversity. And so to think that, you know, all of these Black women who are dying from cancer at disproportionate rates compared to their white counterparts, I think we need to pause a little bit. There's another camp that says what we need to be thinking about are environmental determinants. What is it about where Black women live in this country that seems to make, you know, the strains of breast cancer that they actually have sort of more virulent and more likely to lead to their diagnosis being terminal? That as, and on top of it, are they more or less likely to have mammograms? Are they more or less likely to be getting the types of preventative care that would actually probably allow them to live much longer lives?
Leslie, let's get to the issue of debt and how it intersects with race. How does medical debt disproportionately impact communities of color? And if so, what are the causes of that? We know that medical bankruptcy is one of the leading causes of financial problems that Americans experience because of, you know, our current problems with health insurance. We have a huge healthcare crisis in the United States. But does medical debt disproportionately impact African Americans and in general communities of color? And if so, why?
Yes. And so there are a number of reasons for this. So basically, you know, and this is before the Affordable Care Act, you know, communities of color, you know, had some of the highest rates of of lack of health insurance coverage, right? And that, you know, while simultaneously they tended to live in environments in which, you know, they were exposed to to environmental factors that would actually determine that they would actually need more health care than others. And so when you have that combination of lack of health insurance, right, and also exposure to environmental factors that might lead to lower levels of wellness, you sort of have a perfect storm. And, you know, we're talking about African Americans, we're talking about Latinos, we're talking about some Asian groups as well. You know, we're talking about Native Americans.
And then does the medical profession target groups by race for certain kinds of treatments, prescriptions? And of course, you would expect to go along with that would be differences in costs, which then leads to differences in the debts that people owe. Are different racial groups marketed to by race?
Well, I mean, I think the sort of most infamous example of that is the whole BITL controversy. I don't know if you are familiar with BITL, but it was the first FDA-approved drug that basically targeted a racial or, in this instance, an ethnic group, because people tend to conflate Black and African American. You know, Black is a racial group. Ethnic African American is an ethnic group under the umbrella of the racial group Black. It was specifically approved for the use in African Americans with heart failure. And, you know, long story short, BITL just turned out to be a marketing disaster, didn't make very much money at all. But it was touted as, you know, sort of the savior of African Americans with heart failure. One of the things about BITL, though, is that it was basically taking two generic drugs that actually had been on market, obviously for a long time because they were generic, and doctors actually had been prescribing the two for patients across racial lines who had heart failure, who seemed to respond well to it. What BITL did was it repackaged these two generics into one brand pill, and the cost of that brand pill was significantly, exponentially higher than the cost of those two generics together.
Wow.
So that's one example. Although, I mean, as Ann Pollock in the volumes points out, you know, we shouldn't fetishize, you know, this one pill. You know, while the pills are much more expensive than the generics are, you know, the cost of healthcare is much greater than the cost of a pill. And considering that, you know, especially in communities of color, ones that are heavily segregated, you tend to have fewer healthcare providers per resident. The quality of those healthcare providers, you know, are very often not as high as the quality that you'll find in other communities. And, you know, when you have lack of providers, lower quality providers, and then you also have, you know, these sort of instances in which you have people of color either being pushed certain treatments that other groups aren't because they're seen as being targeted towards them, or actually not being provided other treatments that other groups are provided for. You have, you know, you really, really have this high possibility of misdiagnosis, mistreatment, and as a result, higher healthcare costs.
And so this, you know, you imagine human beings, we're biologically the same, race is a social construct. And so treatments for medical conditions should apply to all human beings, regardless of how they are viewed within a racial framework. You know, you might treat men and women differently because we have different biological components in systems to some extent, but you wouldn't treat treat, you shouldn't treat a Black woman's cancer differently from a white woman's cancer, simply, you know, if the cancers are identical. But you see that disparity nonetheless. We shouldn't be seeing this in today's day and age, but we still do. And I'm assuming that's why the term subprime health, sort of hearkening back to the idea of the subprime mortgage crisis, is an appropriate term, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I mean, one of the things that interests me a lot, and one of the reasons why we were so excited to have this edited volume with people across disciplines, who are very invested in this work in health disparities and what we call race-based medicine, is I think it's really important to look across institutions to see the way that race and racism and discrimination operate, you know, both within specific institutional contexts and also across contexts. And I really do believe those places in which we see agreement, in which we see similarities across institutions, are actually where we actually sort of get to the nitty-gritty of what structural racism is. When we see that concordance, and I think that in looking at the subprime mortgage crisis and in looking at the things that led to that crisis and how people of color, and in particular Blacks and Latinos, were the worst victims of that subprime crisis, largely not because, as many people think, because so many of those people shouldn't have been afforded a mortgage in the first place. I mean, and, you know, and to the extent that they were pretty much targeted by mortgage companies. They didn't go out looking for them. But also, number two, those people of color who actually should have been given prime mortgages were actually given subprime mortgages anyway, right? Mm-hmm. So this had absolutely nothing to do with whether or not they could afford, prime repayment options, right? And we see many of the same things in medicine, right? There are these assumptions made based on one's ascriptive characteristics, and that is, in this case, race, that one either can or cannot afford something, that one either does or does not deserve something, that one has more or less of something within one's biological makeup, right? That requires different treatment, and that often leads to disastrous consequences for those people of color. But I think one of the things that I think we in this country need to understand is that, you know, so goes the minority population in the United States, so goes the rest of the country. And the subprime mortgage crisis, for example, didn't just take down communities of color, although it disproportionately impacted them in terms of the loss of wealth. But I mean, it's something that reverberated across the country and across the globe, actually.
I want to end, Leslie, with looking at the current political moment that we are in. President Obama joined a list of other presidents in trying to reform the healthcare system. What we got was the Affordable Care Act, a flawed bill that was still better than that the status quo at the time. And of course, now Trump has worked very hard, and the GOP has worked very hard to destroy Obamacare from the inside. And along the way, and you have a chapter in the book that you've edited, Obamacare and Sovereign Debt, one of the contributions that takes on this issue. If we are to address these racial disparities in medicine, would a universal healthcare system that provides free healthcare to all, that's taxpayer funded, some call it a Medicare for All system or single payer system, would that go some ways toward addressing these racial disparities?
So that's a very complicated question. Within the volume,
because then you wouldn't have this issue of the ability to pay or perceptions of whether insurance companies will get repaid or pharmaceutical companies can market directly to communities, et cetera.
Yeah, well, so, you know, in tackling with what we meant by race-based medicine, what we meant by race-based medicine, it went from the very micro in terms of here's a pill that's devised just for this certain group to the sort of the more macro level of healthcare delivery. And for sure, access to healthcare, basically in terms of health insurance, is just one very small part of healthcare delivery. Just because one has health insurance doesn't mean you're going to have health providers in your community. And I think that that is something that we see. I'm here in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. has one of the highest rates of health insurance coverage in the United States. However, it also has, I think, a fairly high rate of health insurance through Medicaid. And, you know, despite the fact that these communities are insured, you have very few providers who want to come in to those communities and provide them with high quality care. Now, perhaps if we had universal health insurance and everyone had the same, at least the same basic health insurance package, would that mean we'd have the same number of providers per capita in different communities of the same quality? I'm not sure. And there's also the part of what we call race-based medicine that goes towards the treatment and diagnosis of different types of people and different types of bodies. And I think that that goes to how individuals are trained in medical school.
Absolutely. We have the issues of implicit bias that runs through all of this.
Exactly. So, doctors to be don't show up in medical school these empty vessels, right? I mean, they come to medical schools with biases, just like we all have. And to what extent do medical schools help to address those biases? To what extent do they help to actually confirm them? Universal healthcare coverage is just one small part of helping to ensure that everyone's health is addressed and valued the same way in this country.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Leslie, for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
My guest is Leslie R. Hinkson, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University and co-editor with Nadine Ehlers of the book we've just been discussing, Subprime Health, Debt and Race in U.S. Medicine. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a political prisoner and award-winning journalist, and he recently filed this commentary.
Cracks in the walls of empire. The gates. As we gather today, we do so amid the fire and smoke of chaos, both figuratively and literally. In France, the city of light, Paris, is surrounded by the flames of discontent. The rural communities are up in arms about lowering wages and the hiking of taxes. These people, clad in their yellow vests, feel that they are forgotten by the central government and often ignored by them and the urban elites. In Britain, the nation is trying to come to terms with a serious self-imposed wound, Brexit. Brexit, or a British exit from the European Union is a British attempt to go it alone. But to do so means that the country will lose billions of pounds or dollars as international companies flee from London and as jobs also leave the country. London, called the city for its impressive economic strength, is frittering away that strength because of Brexit. The U.S. economy, roaring like a lion as it breaks all records of the Dow Stock Exchange, is now falling like stones as stocks reflect losses that bring to mind the Great Depression of the 1930s. Why should we worry about such things? Because when the economy falls, when economic insecurity enters a nation, it opens the door to fear. And history has shown us that it opens the door into fascism. Europe is already home to formidable rightist forces. The events of a year ago in Charlottesville, Virginia, showed the sinister flash of fascism in a major American city. These fears, once unleashed, cannot be easily brought back under control. These furies of the mind light fires in consciousness, and fires in the mind can only too soon become fires in fact, which consumes and destroys societies. Fascism, or the collusion of corporate power with state governmental power, can result when traditional governments have failed to resolve economic problems in states awash in economic insecurity. John Bellamy Foster, editor of the American Socialist Magazine Monthly Review, defines fascism as characterized by its virulently xenophobic, ultra-nationalist tendencies, which is rooted primarily in the lower middle class and relatively privileged sections of the working class, in alliance with monopoly capital. History has shown that the deification of leaders, and well as the exaltation of the military, is also a feature of fascist states. As capitalism reaches its market limits, it seeks other forms through which it can extract profits. Fascism. The late German dramatist Bertolt Brecht asks in 1935, how can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he is willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth? Thus, we can glimpse a key relationship between fascism and capitalism. One is but a tool of an economic system which utilizes the other for power and profit. One would think that the heinous and horrors of massacres of World War II would awaken us to the fascism and the neo-fascism that we see emerging in Europe and the U.S. One would think, yes, but neoliberalism itself, a political system designed to serve corporate interests by betraying the public sphere for private capitalists' accumulation, has prepared the ground for this neo-fascist and crypto-fascist ascendancy. Neoliberalists like the Clintons built the machine we now name mass incarceration. How could this not strengthen and deepen a system built on repression of workers, racism, and corporate control and domination? In Britain, Brexit spells economic disaster and the devolution of Britain as one of the centers of Europower. In France, attempts to operate the nation as if it were a simple business run by a banker has run into a wall, one richly emblazoned with mottos comparing the president with kings who face the guillotine. In America, the notion of president who was a businessman has lost much of its luster as the state appears like a site of chaos and sheer incompetence. And beneath it all lurks the threat of fascism, ugly, racist, profoundly undemocratic, and beholden only to corporate capitalist power. It is a time for all of us of awakening. Thank you for your time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Mumia Abu Jamal is a political prisoner and award-winning journalist. You can listen to this and all his other commentaries at prisonradio.org. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band, Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, wanna drive out to
KBOO Portland.
Hi everyone, I'm Henry, and I'd like to invite you to listen to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. My co-hosts and I are three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad.